From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, and welcome to The Doctor Is In. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
I'm at a loss, Joel.
Oh, my.
No, I want to talk about loss and all the various ways that that precious RF power that appears at the jack on the back of the radio there may or may not make it all the way to the antenna to be radiated. But before we get into that, though, you had something.
Yes, speaking of loss, I left something out. In the March 1st episode, we discussed the various ramifications of adding a linear amplifier to your station to provide some negative loss, or what we usually call gain. I neglected to mention an important consideration, and fortunately a note from Terry, K9TAD, reminded me. And the point is that any time you make any change in your station to increase your radiated power, either by adding an amplifier or a gain antenna or even a different antenna in a different part of your yard, you're required to redo your RF safety analysis.
Oh, that's right. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, it's very important. And particularly because for many people on HF, especially on the lower bands that we're mostly using these days, the normal 100-watt transceiver is, while not exempted, it's considered to be safe under most conditions. Now, as soon as you add a linear amplifier, now you're in the realm of having to talk about doing a serious point-by-point evaluation to determine how much power gets to your neighbor's area and how much bothers you and your family in your residence. So you do need to make that detailed assessment as part of adding an amplifier to your station.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a good point. Yeah. Very good point to make. Now, back to loss.
Yes.
Because I'm still at a loss.
Yes. Well, loss happens. I mean, it's one of those things. And it basically, anything that you put a signal passes through, will result in some attenuation. And just because, if nothing else, every conductor has some resistance. And anytime you have resistance, you get loss. So that's kind of the fundamental piece to this puzzle. Of course, the one thing that will not cause loss that you could run a signal through is an amplifier, but that's sort of something we already talked about, so we won't talk about that. So we'll talk about other kinds of things, and the amount of power reduction that occurs in the connection arrangement is a function of how much electrical resistance the device inserts, but also, just as important, is the load impedance that it's driving. So for example, if we're dealing with the typical 50-ohm system that we often work with, and we have a connection resistance of 5 ohms, which is really kind of high, but just an easy number to work with. The voltage at the output as it drives into 50 ohms will be 50 fifths of what went in. So it's, if there were no loss, it would be 50 fiftieths, and which would be no loss, but 50 fifths is 0.83 decibels, for example. So that's just an example of how this works. It's basically a voltage divider arrangement. So that isn't too dramatic, but suppose we had the same 5 ohms connection resistance going to a loaded short monopole antenna. Now they have a very low, typically low radiation resistance, and it might be as low as 5 ohms. Now if that were the case, we would have a voltage divider with 5 ohms of resistance and 5 ohms of antenna that we're putting the power into, and the power would divide equally between the two. So that same 5 ohm resistance now, because it's voltage we're talking about, results in a 6 decibel loss. So it's important not just to look at the series resistance that you're inserting in the connections or whatever. It's also important to look at the load on the other side of that. So so you can't just look at the resistance part. You have to look at the whole thing. And small loops also share this problem that loaded antennas have, because they have very low impedance. And that's why people go to great lengths to have welded connections and serious thick copper loops to reduce the resistance as much as possible.
Now, you're talking about what some people call magnetic loops.
Some people would call them magnetic loops, and I guess that's a fairly descriptive term. And they're popular because they're very small.
Yes.
I guess you can kind of take away from this that the smaller you make an antenna compared to a wavelength, typically, the lower the, I'll probably, some of you will have an exception for me, but typically the impedance or the radiation resistance goes down and it's harder to get power into it. And the losses are more important for a smaller antenna. So that's just one of those facts of life. There's no free lunch there. Now, in many situations, the biggest element of loss is the transmission line, and which many people use coax cable, and all coax is not created equal, as we know. But even in coax, the major loss element is the electrical resistance of the center conductor. So we're still talking resistance here, so which is pretty easy to figure out. The issue is, though, it's not the DC resistance of that wire, it's the AC resistance.
And because RF is AC, after all.
It is indeed. And what makes it important to take that into account is that in DC, the current distributes across the whole area of the wire. So you have a lot of places for it to go and less resistance because all those paths are in parallel. As you get to higher and higher frequencies, the skin effect forces the current to be out near the outside edge. So it's as if you had a tube and the center part of the wire is not being used. The higher the frequency, the thinner the wall of the tube, and the higher the resistance. So that's why the loss in coax cable goes up with frequency. So that's one thing to think about. Now, why do I say the center conductor? Well, the outer conductor is significantly larger in diameter than the inner. So while there is resistance in the shield as well, it's usually lower than that of the center conductor. So we can sort of look at the center conductor and picture what's happening. Now, having said that, people say, well, wait a minute. If I look at the coax cable specs, I look at different kinds of dielectric, like the old standard coax cable is semi-solid polyethylene plastic insulation, and that has more loss than the newer foam insulation cable. Many may wonder why the type of dielectric material between the inner conductor and shield should matter, since the loss is, at least at HF, is determined by the electrical resistance of the center conductor primarily. So the regular kind of coax with solid polyethylene, such as RG8 or RG58, has more loss than similar sized coax with a foam dielectric, which has more loss than air dielectric coax. But the dielectric actually has a secondary effect. The characteristic impedance of the coax is determined by the log of the ratio of the diameters of the outer to inner conductor. The characteristic impedance then goes down with the square root of the dielectric constant. So a higher dielectric constant, as in the 2.26 of polyethylene, requires a thinner inner conductor for the same characteristic impedance than does foam or air, which has air has a dielectric constant of 1. It is the thinner wire that makes the loss higher, not the dielectric material itself. Okay.
Now, that makes sense, really. Yeah. It's something that I had not thought of. Before we go on, and I do have a couple of other examples, let's hear from DX Engineering, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling, too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime, and we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel. We've been talking about loss in coaxial cable, but loss can occur in other devices or at other places. Connectors. What about coaxial connectors? Don't they have loss?
They do, but it's at HF particularly, it's almost negligible. Now, the other part of transmission line loss, which relates to connectors, is the loss goes up with the mismatch. Typically, the best circumstance for cable is to have it driving a load that's matched to the characteristic impedance. There are actually exceptions to that, but I don't think we need to go into that. If the coax is mismatched, what that means is that at some portions the voltage will be higher than it would be if it were matched, and at some places the current would be higher. And the higher current through the resistance results in additional loss, and it more than offsets the reduction in loss during the places with the high voltage. So for minimum loss, in most coax situations, it's important to have the transmission line matched to the load. This is why it makes a difference whether you have an antenna tuner that's doing the matching out at the antenna so the coax is matched the whole way, or back at the radio, in which case you can get a perfect match at that end of the cable, but the cable going from the tuner to the antenna will be still be mismatched and will result in more loss than you need to have. Now, why does that relate to coax connectors? Well, our typical so-called UHF connector that almost all HF transceivers use was designed back in the days when UHF meant 30 megahertz and up, and people didn't worry as much about many of the things that we worry about today. The actual impedance of a coax, UHF coax connector, is something like 30 ohms. So it's not matched to the cable. Now, what does that mean? What it means is you have a couple of inches of 30-ohm coaxial cable effectively in your system.
Exactly.
Now, does that cause a problem? Well, it results in a transformation of the impedance on one side to the other. And it's on the lower HF frequencies, it makes almost no difference because the length in terms of wavelength is so short that the transformation is minimal. It's almost the same impedance going into it as there is coming out of it. Now, that works typically reasonably well up to the VHF range. When you get to 2 meters, it starts to become a fraction of a wavelength, 2 inches out of, I'm not going to do numbers in my head on this. But anyway, it becomes a not a terribly significant, but a somewhat significant fraction of a wavelength. So there will be a transformation, and that will result in the next section of cable having a mismatched load. So that will increase the loss, not so much in the connector itself, but in the cable that follows it. So at 432, it makes a lot of difference. And anything above that, it's very significant because it becomes a significant portion of a wavelength. So the solution to that is to pick a connector that is a constant impedance connector. And there are some, and they're much better for VHF work than UHF connectors are, in spite of their name. So the ones that are constant impedance that are commonly encountered are type N and B and C. And if you look at them, they're actually the same. The inside of them are the same. And you can actually use B and C jumper cables with type N.
Yes.
Connectors, which not everybody knows about it, in one direction only. I guess the back shell won't fit in there. But anyway, the type N or B and C connector, and at high power levels, there's a larger one that's like a type N, but is bigger and can handle a higher voltage due to the spacing, and that's an HN connector, the same kind of a bayonet mount connector. There's also a type C, which is like a type N, except it's bayonet. I think the HN is a screw-on type. I haven't seen one in a long time. But anyway, so there are connectors that solve that problem, But if there is a loss in a connector, it is probably due to it not being tight or not being properly assembled. And both of those things are fairly common, particularly with UHF connectors, because one of their shortcomings is unless the back shell is tight, the shield connectivity is poor.
Yes.
That has to be tight to work. And, of course, you put it in your car, you drive 100,000 miles, and you go back and you look in the trunk and, oh, the shield's off. And how is this thing working at all? So I make it a practice of giving just a little bit of a twist with a pair of pliers on my back shells on UHF connectors to make sure they stay put, especially in the mobile environment.
Now, what about losses due to antenna tuners being in the line or other devices? Antenna switches come to mind? Other meters?
Yeah, everything has loss. Now, in many cases, it's not a great deal of loss, but the problem is they keep adding up. You know, it's not just one thing or another thing. It's one thing and another thing and another thing and another thing. And like the federal budget, you know, a billion here, a billion there. Before you know it, you're talking real money. Antenna tuners are an interesting topic because the amount of loss they have, of course, also depends on frequency. And it depends on the design of the tuner and how it's constructed and, you know, how thick the wire is on the inductors and all that kind of thing. One advantage we have is all members can look at all product reviews that have ever been done. And you can look up the product review of an antenna tuner you're thinking of. And if you know roughly what impedance it's going to have to match, you can find out what the loss is on each band for the sample that we measured in the lab. And typically, it's not too terrible, but there are some exceptions. And there are some tuners that were highly regarded that have some big problems at high SWR. Now, most tuners, what I call a wide-range tuner, can match up to a 10-to-1 SWR, but that doesn't mean that when it does that, the loss will be as low as if it were a 2-to-1 SWR.
Yes.
So it's important to know about that, and the data is available for most tuners. A surprising thing that I found was that I always thought that the big tuners, manually tuned tuners, would have much lower loss than the small, compact, automatic tuners with the small wires. But if you look at the data, they actually don't typically. the automatic tuners, which are typically L networks, perhaps because they have ferrite-based inductors and less wire, therefore, than open wire or air-wound inductors, they come out with very good results that are comparable to manual tuners. There may be exceptions, but the ones that I've seen that have had surprising amounts of losses under certain conditions were manual tuners, generally.
That is surprising.
But the important thing is the data's there. If you're thinking about a tuner and thinking about your antenna with it, find out what the impedance is of your antenna and see what the different tuners will do to drive that.
Now, what if I've got a switch on the line?
Well, switches don't have to have a lot of loss. The better switches have strap-type conductors that are installed in such a way that they act like strip line transmission line within the box of the switch. There's no reason for them to have a lot of loss. Now, that doesn't mean that you couldn't design a switch that had loss, and it's a good idea to understand what's in it. There are really a couple things to think about with a switch. One is the loss going through the switch, which is what we've been talking about. And of course, when you have a switch, you now have two additional coax connectors that you didn't have to have on each side of it, and that's, you know, total of four coax connectors. And each one of those could be loose.
Yes.
And but the other factor about switches, which is not so important from a loss standpoint, is the crosstalk rating. In other words, if you have a switch that has, let's say, a isolation between two ports of 30 decibels, that sounds like a lot. But if you put a kilowatt into one port, that means you'll have 1 watt coming out on the other port that you aren't, that it isn't switched to.
Now, one watt that you might be putting into the front end of a receiver.
Exactly right. So if you have two radios there, and your typical modern solid-state transceiver will not handle 1 watt on the input port. So it's very important that you understand all the ramifications of switches, and it's not just losses, it's also this isolation thing. And some people publish specs about that. Usually they're better than 30 dB. They're usually 40 dB if they publish specs. And then the people that don't publish specs, well, what is their isolation? Who knows? Now, this is not as big a problem if you're switching antennas, because if you put that 1 watt, you know, you have your switch from your 20-meter beam to your dipole on 80 meters or something. If you're using the beam and you end up putting 1 watt of power on 20 meters into your 80-meter dipole, it's going to radiate somewhere, and it might not help your front-to-back ratio or your rejection of signals in certain directions, but it's not going to be the end of the world. You put it into your other transceiver, on the other hand, and that could be the end of that
the
world.
End of the world, yeah.
End of that world. So that's another item. You know, we talk about SWR and matching, and some numbers might be useful. Let's talk about the loss, just as an example. If we talk about RG58 coax, very popular, flexible, light, relatively inexpensive. Its loss in 100 feet of cable, when matched, varies from less than 1 decibel at 3.5 megahertz to almost 3 decibels at 28 megahertz. Now, that's half your power and half an S unit as well. Change to the thicker and heavier RG8 or RG213, and the match loss drops to about a third of a dB at 3.5 megahertz and about 1 dB at 28 megahertz. That's a significant difference at the cost of heavier, more expensive cable.
Yes.
And there's higher quality, lower loss foam dielectric cable available that'll be even better than that. Now, what happens if we don't have it matched? If we have a 5-to-1 SWR with our RG58, the 28 megahertz loss increases from 2.8 to 4.8 decibels. That's twice as much attenuation in decibels, and that leaves two-thirds of our power dissipated in the heat from the line. So you put in 100 watts, you radiate 33, and you heat up the room with 66 watts. Multiply, you know, go with higher power, it's even more dramatic. And I've actually burned my hand on lossy cable.
Yes, really.
I was actually checking a ballon to see how lossy it was with a mismatch on it. And it was cool. And I accidentally tipped the coax. And, oh, that was uncomfortable. But anyway, but you might think, well, I never have a 5-to-1 SWR. My antenna SWR measures less than 2-to-1 on 10 meters. So I don't have a problem. Well, here's the story. If you have 100 feet of RG58 between your radio and your with its SWR meter and the antenna, if your meter at the radio shows 2-to-1, which I guess is where you're looking probably, the antenna SWR is actually 5-to-1.
Yes.
Because of the loss in the cable, which reduces the power that goes up to the antenna and reduces the reflected power coming back. So the antenna looks like it's 2-to-1, you think you're in good shape, but actually you're losing two-thirds of your power.
That's why you want to put the antenna tuner, if you can, out at the antenna.
Right, or match the antenna to
start with, which is even better. Yes.
But that's where you want the match to take place. You want to have the full length of the coax be properly matched.
Okay. Are you ready for a question? Well, we have a question from Greg. N4ZZN, and he's asking, I have a modern all-band transceiver, and I love it. Unfortunately, I have yet to figure out what some of the digital signal processing functions do. Specifically, auto notch, beat cancel, and noise blanker. Most of the time, I just turn these on and off to see what sounds best. I feel the manual is too general. Can you explain what each one does, Joel?
Well, let me give it a try. Now, to me, auto notch and beat cancel sound like the same function. And what that basically does is it uses a digital signal processing algorithm to null out any constant frequency signals in the passband. Now, that can be very handy. So, for example, if you have somebody tuning up while you're trying to listen to somebody, that has been known to happen on the ham bands, it'll notch out, automatically zero in and notch out that steady carrier and have minimal impact on the rest of the signals in the passband. So you can still understand, hopefully, your person you're listening to with that little bit of bandwidth taken out. And some of them can do not just one, but multiple tone automatically. That's very handy. It was a real problem in the AM days, and of course it's still with AM segments of the band. If you have two AM stations that are a couple of kilohertz apart, their carriers cause a beat that acts like a single frequency, and this can notch that out. In the old days, we used to have to use the phasing control of our crystal filter to try to notch that out, and it was a much wider notch, and it wasn't anywhere near as deep. So this is much more effective and works very well. Now, the one thing you have to be careful of is if you're working CW, the person you're trying to listen to is sending out a signal on a single frequency, at least you hope, and if you inadvertently have your auto notch on while you're listening to CW, it will work great at removing the CW signal you're trying to listen to. Now, most radios, but not all, most radios disable that function when you're in CW mode, which is handy. And they have instead a manually tuned notch. So if you want to get rid of some other CW signal in the passband, you can get rid of that one manually without interfering with the one you're listening to. But that's a very effective tool. And of course, you won't notice it unless you're having that problem. So if you switch it on and off, and you don't have a carrier in the passband, you won't know that whether it's doing anything or not. And in fact, it doesn't have anything to do because there's nothing there.
That's right.
So that's the auto notch or beat cancel. So when you hear that steady tone in the passband, hit that button and you'll be amazed at how quickly and effectively it disappears if it works as well as mine does. Now, the noise blanker is a completely different kind of function. What that does is that is designed to attack impulse type noise, which is short duration pulse noise such as you might have from an ignition system or some kinds of furnace controllers do that sort of thing.
Like a put, 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 put.
Exactly.
Yes.
And what they do is they basically detect the pulse. They do it in a wide band part of the receiver before it gets to your selectivity, so the pulse is still as narrow as it can be. And they actually turn off the receiver channel while the pulse is there and turn it back on when it's over. And just as with other kinds of time division multiplexers, I mean, you don't notice the quick loss of a signal. Your mind just kind of integrates across it, just as looking at a separate film frames on a movie. You don't notice that it's separate things.
Yes.
It just disappears. The one thing about that is it works better with some kinds of noise than others. If it's a long duration pulse, it's not terribly effective. Why? Because it turns off the radio for a longer duration. And most DSP radios have another function that's related. Sometimes they share the same button. One is a short press, one is a long press. And it's called noise reduction rather than blanking. That's a completely different kind of function. It's designed to analyze the signal that's in the presence of noise, figure out what's signal and what's noise, and digitally enhance the signal by removing the noise components. Unfortunately, in practice, it always sounds a little better than it really is because it's hard to separate the two.
Yes.
It often introduces some distortion.
It certainly does, to the point where I frankly don't use the function all that much.
I don't either, but sometimes you just can't quite hear a station in the noise. And the thing about the noise reduction function is in most radios, you have a choice of different algorithms and different levels of attack and so forth. So you have to spend a little time trying all the different choices. So you hit function one and try adjusting the level and hit function two and function three and so forth. So there are different algorithms and one of them will work better than the others. And if you happen to find one that works very well, you know, it might work today on that signal, but it might not work tomorrow on a different signal with different noise characteristics. So you have to kind of fuss with it. But if it comes down to the difference of being able to understand the person versus not understanding the person, it's worth doing. It's a little less of a hassle to listen to, in my experience, on CW because the nuances of the voice are not something you have to worry about. but you just have to worry about whether the key's down or the key's up. And it still causes some distortion, but you can often find a setting that will actually provide a better receive signal that you can actually copy properly.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.